welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is February 3rd, 2026, and this is episode 579. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, one word, Radio Warnerd, and sign up and support the show. And I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Breccia. You're back in southern Italy?
Yeah, with a brand new ceramic tooth. And we arrived home to find that the windstorm was just as big here as everywhere else in the Mediterranean. And even our very sturdy banana plant got knocked over.
Mm. Our Arctic freeze kind of lifted finally. This was the fourth longest Arctic freeze, that is to say, temperatures never got above, was it single digits or never got above the teens? It's the longest stretch of that in Rochester history, the fourth longest stretch going back about almost 200 years. So we had five of the hottest winters, roughly the hottest winters like on record, and then now one of the coldest, which is, I guess, right? That's supposed to be what it is, the climate change thing. It just gets wackier with the trend line up.
Yeah, the extremes accelerate. But, I mean, I would hate to think what a cold snap like that in the 1800s would have done. Because, I mean, now at least almost everybody, and I say almost because I know not everybody, can stay warm. But not then.
But also thanks to these massive AI data centers that are being built, taxing the grid, and also Trump and Biden's big policy of blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline and then turning the U.S. into a major exporter of liquid natural gas. Gas prices in the U.S. have soared, and so our electricity bill this month anyway, I've never seen anything like it. And It's kind of the 1-2 of AI and the U.S. being this, basically exporting where you can get more money. Well, not you, just a few specific donors can get a lot more money than selling it to American schlubs. So we're all stuck basically paying a tax on that. So yeah, we definitely keep the heat lower than we might normally during this. It's been tough for the dog. You know, we have a puppy. And you can only, dogs also, like, they can only take so much cold.
Especially when they want to sleep, dogs like to sleep warm.
Yes, definitely like to sleep warm. Yeah, so do cats, which always surprise, because cats come from the desert, right? So their body temperatures are naturally kind of high, and you really need like a Siberian type with the paws, with the big tufts between the paws and the big puffy tails. And to be able to handle the cold like this. Otherwise, it's rough. Not a lot of fun. The big news around here in Rochester, I have to say, I was just hearing today, there's all kinds of usual grim corruption, inequality, segregation. But the local paper here, which is like most local papers or nearly all of them around the country outside of New York City, they're just like 8 pages down to that. So it's usually
they seem to specialize in restaurant reviews now.
Yes, restaurant
reviews.
That's
the only way we can compete.
Yep, restaurant reviews, local high school sports in order to get all the parents to subscribe, and developer boosterism. But the big news here is that a Bass Pro Shop, 90,000 square foot Bass Pro Shop is coming to the big mall down in Victor, which is kind of a little slightly more farm country, but has a big mall. So the Bass Pro is, the sea bass. And there, as you can imagine, there's a lot of fishing rods in there. But apparently these stores are like these massive, almost amusement park type stores with like games and restaurants and, little like a Disneyland, like here's Fishing World and here's Hunting World. And so it's a big deal for well, when you don't have a lot going on in your area, right. I guess it's a big deal. And you take the kids there and, you know, they have like tracker, like boats to go out and fishing. And it's like massive mega stores. It looks pretty hellish. I haven't fished in, I don't know if you ever did fishing. Like I did a lot when I was in my tweens, early teens, but never since then.
No, I would tend to get really furious. if no fish meant business after 5 or 10 minutes, I would just sort of think, well, why don't we have the hand grenade method?
I was going to say, reach for the water-resistant M80.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really see the point of it. It's strange to me how super powerful rich people like to fish and hunt. The hunting, I guess I kind of understand because that's what they do every day of their lives in one form or another, but they don't get to actually maybe feel the corpses that they leave behind unless they go out hunting. But fishing is, I liked it when I was younger, but it's you need a lot of time and it's kind of boring.
It's better just to watch the videos on Facebook or something of the key 60 seconds of someone landing a 90-pound shark or something like that.
Yeah. I was reading Mary Surratt's book, Not One Inch, about the expansion of NATO and all of that. And the James Baker stuff, I mean, he's a pretty scary, impressive guy as, you know, imperial stewards go. And she talks about how he liked to go, she writes somewhere about how, you know, he liked to go hunting and how his wife had said something like, he doesn't have a very strongly developed sense of guilt. In fact, he has none whatsoever. So
that dovetails with what someone we both know said about Baker when they said, yeah, he's all right. He's never made his own toast, but
yes. Yeah, but he's killed some wildlife, though, that's for sure, and enjoyed it. All right, so let us talk about, there's so much going on, you know, it's how Trump likes it. He likes to...
Yeah, it's chaos. It's kind of brain-dead chaos.
Brain-dead chaos, and so we all have to run back and look and see what Trump's going to do, and that's how he likes it. Is everybody waiting to see what I'm going to do? I may do it. I may not.
Yeah.
I may do something big and beautiful. May not. I don't know where you want to start. I mean, one of the big... There's so many stories right now. One of the big ones, of course, is if Trump is going to bomb Iran. And where we are right now, I mean, I thought... after the big Epstein dump, which is another, you know, enormous story, just the stuff coming out of that, I thought Trump was going to bomb Iran to distract. I think a lot of people did because, you know, when you have new files that say that Trump forced some teenager to perform oral sex and then he hit her when she bit him or laughed at him or something, whatever. That didn't happen. In fact, once again, there are no real consequences for anybody in this country, at least. I think in Britain, there is more of a sense of accountability.
Well, they have a really well-developed sense of sadistic play. I imagine they're big on hunting, too. And they really kind of enjoy the momentary hunt. Mm. And it is like a hunt because I knew someone in Iraq who was the brother of someone who'd been a 3-day sensation as a love rat or something, and he said it's kind of remarkable. It's like the 10 minutes hate for 10 minutes. You are the enemy of the people. But the U.S. can't enjoy that in the same way. And too many people feel a humorless identification with Trump and his minions. So they just don't see the fun in it.
Right. The only person who seems to be getting any blowback here, despite all the wealthy, powerful people, you know, who have had even crazier revelations come out about them and allegations, is Dr. I don't know him, but I've known from this story, Dr. Peter Attia. He's apparently like an anti-woke doctor podcaster. And he was, Barry Weiss, who of course has, you know, taken over CBS News, made some big announcement about how she was going to really, you know, put CBS News on the map for the new age, the new era that we live in, by bringing in fresh new voices with fresh centrist voices. And it was going to include Dershowitz, but I guess she left him out of it at the moment. But one of the persons that she brought in as a regular contributor was this guy, Peter Attia, whose name appears more than 1,700 times in the latest Jeffrey Epstein release.
Wow.
So she, Barry Weiss, is probably friends with him. So she decided to play the other card, which is, I'm against cancel culture. She, who like got her whole start at Columbia canceling Palestinian professors and that, you know, destroying their lives, she's anti-cancel culture when her side gets it, and then pro-cancel culture when it has to do with hurting Israel. So she's decided to save him, which I'm kind of glad she did. It's almost better that way, I think, you know. Don't pretend to have some kind of principles here. Just fuck it, go with it.
No, in a way, I find the Barry Weiss story a lot healthier than other news that people have just shrugged and accepted, because everybody understands she was dumped in place, and really that's the expression, dumped into place by a few billionaires, because she will do what they say. And people don't seem to understand that as much about other stories as they do about Weiss.
Yes. So getting back to Iran real quickly, Trump didn't bomb Iran yet, but the U.S. has continued to move a lot of assets into place, and Trump has been, you know, threatening them over and over. In fact, just a couple of days ago, through his social media, Truth Social, Trump, a massive armada is heading to Iran. It is a larger fleet headed by the great aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln than that sent to Venezuela. Like with Venezuela, it is ready, willing, and able to rapidly fulfill its mission with speed and violence if necessary. Yada, yada, yada.
It always makes me sad that they don't really try to bring the carriers in on this, because based on what we saw when aircraft carriers ventured into the Gulf to intimidate the Houthis, not only were they not intimidated, but it seems, judging by the quick exit and news blackout of the commanders in the Navy, that they got scared, because carriers are extremely vulnerable.
Yeah, it weren't worth it. Yeah. But there is the carrier group, and at least judging by what the news is reporting, it's keeping a good distance from Iran. It is, you know, whereas during the sort of the Yemen strikes, I think the carrier group was in the Gulf of Aden and or the Red Sea, so it was too close and not taking them seriously enough, and then it had to snagglepuss far away. This one is well off Oman, probably well off of Oman. But there are destroyers and literal ships, the near shore ships that have that kind of literal cyber truck.
Literal with an O.
Yeah. There are several destroyers with cruise missiles. The USS Lincoln aircraft carrier, safely far away, has, I don't know, I think F-35s, F-18s. There are all kinds of reconnaissance and electronic aircraft for guiding and jamming, you know, to go along with a raid. There are probably submarines in the area with a lot of cruise missiles. I mean, they moved in a lot of firepower. Yeah. What the hell it'll do? I think, you know, Trump is just looking to see if whatever is done can make him look good or not. Like the last time he baselessly declared that he'd completely destroyed their whole nuclear program for, like, you know, millennia to come. And that wasn't true, but nobody could really check it at the time. And then they forgot when it was turned, when it turned out not to be true. It's hard to know what you'd declare this time. I mean, this, I don't even know exactly why Trump is doing this, except, you know, because he does everything for the Israelis because his major funders pledge more fealty to Israel than the U.S. But also he does these things to look strong and to look like he's doing things and to distract people. So you don't want a distraction that makes you look bad. You want a distraction that you can plausibly sell, shows how
And he also may
are.
Be subject to some really serious blackmail based on Epstein. I mean, if he was fucking a 13-year-old and then hit her after she laughed at him, that would be some pretty serious things. Even committed Trump fans might object to that.
You know, I'd say yes, but there's so much out there, and it hasn't done anything. I just, you know, and I've seen MAGA people, except for really Marjorie Taylor Greene is practically the only one who really went against that.
She's an interesting case.
I've been saying this for a while now. I know she's got, you know, some horrible politics and all that, but I think she and some of the MAGA stuff that she's kind of aligned, I do think it's interesting. She came out and said MAGA is a lie. It's built on a lie.
I know.
That's a big thing to say when your president's in
power. For one thing, it's in clear English. Yeah. And that's something the leadership of the Democratic Party no longer understands.
Yeah. I think Hakeem Jeffries was a lawyer for CBS and Viacom. Like, that's the kind of person they have. A real firebrand, you know, meeting the moment. There's all this firepower gathered around Iran. Witkoff is supposed to meet on Friday with Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. They're meeting in Istanbul. You know, the last time Trump was negotiating or claimed to be negotiating with the Iranians, literally the last time, it was all a deception to provide cover for a surprise attack for the Israelis. And he bragged about it later. Yeah, we negotiated with them to set them at ease, to make Israel's, you know, decapitation strikes more successful. But this is one of these situations, and there's a lot of this going around right now with Trump, where weaker countries don't have a lot of choices. I mean, China or Russia could say, we're not going to negotiate with you, presumably. But Iran, at the very least, does have to constantly try to hold off American strikes. I mean, it may turn out really badly for Trump if he does this, and the U.S., depending on how far they want to go with it. But it for sure will turn out badly one way or another. Even if it's a total victory, it's going to turn out badly for Iran, for Iranians, perhaps even the government there, the state. So, you know, you do have to try to hold it off. And you see this with in Latin America, particularly. Like, Venezuela has been broken, not completely. I mean, their options were be killed and be replaced by the most horrible, vengeful right-wing goons, or give up Maduro and comply as much as possible to forestall a complete, you know, smashing of the state. And so that's what Delcy Rodriguez is doing now, complying as much with Trump as possible to forestall it. More to that point, too, I don't know if you saw this. Now Trump, after breaking or partially breaking Venezuela, now they're openly focusing on Cuba. We knew that was going to happen, but Trump has announced that they're going to do a full embargo, like complete siege warfare on Cuba. And that means no oil to Cuba. So they've got Venezuela to cut off oil to Cuba. And now he's strong-arming Claudia Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico, because they deliver to Cuba both humanitarian oil and they sell it oil or barter it oil. And so she had to go on social media and it was humiliating for a sovereign leader, but had to say, okay, well, we're being threatened. So she basically said, we're one part of the oil deal with Cuba, we are stopping because Trump is threatening Mexico if they don't cut off oil to Cuba. And Cuba's collapsing right now. She was a bit more kind of vague about whether the humanitarian oil will be cut off. I mean, she seemed to say, like, this is a separate thing and we're looking into it. I think she's trying to find a way to be able to deliver a humanitarian shipments of oil to Cuba, but it doesn't look good. And what can you do with this psychotic hegemon threatening you? There aren't a whole lot of options.
Yeah, it's as if the things that, I don't know, that I at least imagined we could do, being a 20-year-old bitter commuting student, are really being done now. And
yeah,
since I'm a whole lot older and a lot more disaffected, or disaffected in a new way, you start to see, yeah, that's something that's going to look very clever to your big fans in their power ties, but it's not going to look very good down the line for anybody who has to live in the same world with a power that has now been revealed to be willing to do anything. And you know, granted, anybody who hadn't figured that out about the U.S. wasn't really paying attention.
Yeah.
But it's really been slapping them in the face now, and that is going to make people very wary down the line.
I would think so. The prime minister, I guess he's called, of Greenland, just said what I think should be obvious, which is Trump still wants to take Greenland. He is ruled out, which doesn't mean anything, using military force for now, but he's going to keep trying, and that's not going to stop.
Yeah, and besides, once you've said, I'm so clever, I tell lies to people.
I know.
You can't do that too many times. Yeah.
Can you believe they believed me? I thought that was one. Anyway, I mean, I think what Trump knows is people will believe what they want to believe. And nobody wants to believe they're going to be invaded by the U.S. because it's fucking scary for other people. Which also reminds me, I just have to say, I don't know if you saw this. Trump, I think, disparaged the contributions from the Danish and NATO to NATO operations in Afghanistan and elsewhere, which is a classic Trump move, like what he did about, you know, John McCain being a loser.
Right.
But he disparaged that. And you just had this, just like on BBC and from the Danish and from others, this whining like, God, we helped you kill brown people. We were your, you know, imperialist sidekicks. How can you then become imperialist against us? That's not fair, you know? We're supposed to do it together against other people. You're not supposed to do it to us. But, you know, you're right. I mean, I wonder, is this really going to deeply change, let's say, the European allies' view of the U.S. in a fundamental way? Because I thought that for a while with Bush Jr.'s administration. They were so openly dismissive to the point of hostility of the major NATO allies because they wouldn't go along correctly with the Iraq war invasion. And, you know, America's standing in Europe, you know, the polls kind of like now, people in Europe don't like the Americans anymore. And then all you had to do was elect a fake progressive black man, and they all came running back and gave him the Nobel Prize, even though his policies weren't like massively different. He's still bombing and destroying countries. But he wasn't attacking the Europeans. So they're like, okay, good. Thank God we can get back to being the sidekick. And then Trump comes in and it's like, oh my God, America's bad. Then Biden comes in. Okay, we're back in business. Now Trump's there. So I feel like this is more serious, but I'm skeptical that they won't come running back the next European-friendly leader takes office. They want to be, they want to leverage our power to exercise their own power over the world. That's right. Their ideal situation for the Europeans.
So, I suppose what I sort of counter guess is that there are a lot of problems coming up for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to run into some problems that are urgent enough that they have to play their own version of hardball. And they are willing to play hardball. They're perfectly ruthless in mm-hmm. world terms. But they just do it in a different way.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, they are suddenly... the funniest thing I thought was... Having listened to the BBC, you know, you have to listen to the enemy press and read them. And, you know, you get good information and you also get establishmentology tea leaves from them as well. And if you listen to the BBC over the last five, six years, it's very Cold War against China. And suddenly the Europeans figured, you know, we basically destroyed our relationship with, you know, the biggest economy or the second biggest economy in the world, the biggest manufacturing economy, just for America to be part of their power circle and really not getting anything from it. So let's start talking to the Chinese and maybe get some leverage again with the Americans that way. And suddenly the BBC is like, you know, China is turning a corner, and it's like,
yep.
Sir Keir Starmer is visiting, and can relations be saved? Nothing about the Uyghur, you know, quote-unquote genocide. Nothing about even, well, a little bit about Hong Kong, because that can be sold as more like a democracy story.
It's not Ai Weiwei's fault, but mm-hmm. somehow you can track this usually by seeing how many times he's been interviewed
yes.
in the past month.
Well, have you seen Ai Weiwei's, what happened with him?
He was
the favorite dissident. Yeah, he has been living in Germany and he came out in support of Palestine and started getting really attacked for it. And he finally left for China and he said, I actually feel more freedom in China than Germany. The authoritarianism is much more decentralized and within people's brains and culture rather than top down
yeah.
in China. It all was very sensible. And so no one quotes him anymore. He's gone.
Wow.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me a little bit of what happened with Solzhenitsyn, who was always a kook, but he was held up as Jesus by the Cold Warriors, especially like the David Remnick wing of the intellectual Cold Warriors.
Yeah, and it was a kind of blue stocking, it was revealed. And it was the 70s, and it was not quite the done thing.
No. And then, but they still held him up as, you know, the moral conscience of real Russia. And then Boris Yeltsin comes to power, and Solzhenitsyn comes to visit Russia for the first time, and he says, this is the most corrupt, horrible... You know, a trust, like he just absolutely savages correctly the Yeltsin regime and the so-called democracy. And suddenly it turns out he was an anti-Semite and nobody takes him seriously anyway. And that was it. He was gone. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there always was something very careful in a very scheming way about Solzhenitsyn's portrayal of Jews in his historical novels in particular.
Yes.
It was not openly hostile. It was just very, very careful. It sort of stank of the lamp, as the Athenians would have said.
Yeah. It's sort of like, these Jews just happen to be here. I'm just asking questions. I'm just presenting facts. I mean, but if you're...
Whereas there's a real difference between his attitude toward Jews and, say, Limonov's, Russian Jews in particular, which is like, oh yeah, those guys, what a bunch of swats, always studying all the time. Yeah. And you can tell there's no real malice in it. There's just kind of dumb old received ideas.
Well, like Limonov's, I think, is more like what you'd see in New York City in intra-ethnic. This is how I felt a lot of this stuff was in Moscow. You know, every ethnic group has bad things to say about the other ethnic groups, but they're also right. friends with them and do business with them and can party with them and then talk shit about them. And that, I think, was more of Limonov's. And in fact, you know, Limonov got annoyed because of the circles he moved in by anti-Semites. He just thought
yeah,
it was
the humorless
them.
Kind, the yes. dead serious kind.
Yeah, yeah. He just thought it was embarrassing, I think. Embarrassing and primitive. And to be like a dedicated anti-Semite. But to also be like overly concerned with anti-Semitism was also just, I don't know, a ruse, I think, in his mind. Whereas Solzhenitsyn was like, damn it, everywhere I look, Jews. I can't say it.
But, which you know. Shows you that a sense of humor kind of helps sometimes. Because yes. Nobody ever accused Solzhenitsyn of having a lot of that. But
no.
In a deadpan Russian way, Limonov was full of humor.
It's I could almost imagine a Monty Python skit with Solzhenitsyn as like, you know, it would be good as a soccer announcer or something. Like it would have, because he's so damn serious, self-serious, and you know, the bearded, mudri.
Why mudri. Did you miss that goal? What were you doing Friday night?
Yes. If you look back, he was, you know, anyways, here we should cover the SDF story. It's a grim story. It's a story we've covered for a while. It's a story that Radio Warner guest Joshua Landis first pointed us towards the you know, almost inevitable bad ending that is happening now.
Yeah, and he took a lot of heat for that too, and he was right.
Yeah, so I know you've been you wanted to talk about it too, and
what I found somewhat elucidates the situation in the Kurdish areas of Syria, particularly the situation before the Assad government, if you can call it that, fell. Because there was always a strange vacuum in the Syrian situation when it was a three-cornered war, multi-cornered war. The Assad government and its armed wing, the SAA, versus roughly the jihadi militias, with the Kurds not taking the opportunity to do a deal with the Assad government, which was slightly less crazy than the jihadis, and never seeming to open negotiations with them. But what I've seen since suggests that the SAA and Assad in particular was just too damn stupid to make a deal that he and his cohorts thought of their country as inviolable, which would be nice, except it wasn't, and that the Kurdish defection from the one happy family of Syria was somehow particularly offensive. I mean, you see this attitude a lot. A lot of Kurds get hated in many places. But particularly the Middle East, for various reasons, like people see them as not true Muslims and correctly as not true Arabs because they're not, and think of them as having dubious friends in foreign places, which is somewhat true. But when you have to make any deal you can to survive, you know, it's not pretty. But the Assad government never made a deal, or as far as I can tell, made any attempt to make a deal with the Kurds. And it just seemed like an opportunity that was going wasting. But there are other angles to that, very much so, particularly the U.S. and the Israeli and the Turkish angles. And those are some pretty sharp and nasty angles. Basically, none of those three powers wanted the Kurds to do a deal with Assad because they wanted Assad gone. and they kept holding out the possibility that they would do some kind of miraculously friendly deal with the Kurds once Assad was gone. And that was a lie, of course. But, you know, when you're desperate, you'll believe a lot of things. And the Kurds had at least established, through really heroic resistance, some enclaves that held up for a while and were capable of defending themselves and even doing a lot of the NATO's dirty work in destroying the jihadis. But they were always going to be abandoned. And it felt like a sore tooth. I have a lot of experience of sore teeth. Mm-hmm. And you feel them every now and then, and it's like, ow, 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 that hurts. It's going to hurt worse in time. And I just hope that gets delayed as long as possible. And sure enough, over the past few weeks, there were a lot of puzzled, hurt SDF fighters mm-hmm. who'd seen a lot of their friends die and really believed that the U.S., the Israelis, or even in some cases the Turks, might come through on their promises. And that was not to be. They had all gone in with the new regime in Damascus, the Sharah. And he was quite capable of turning on a dime. Now, that is something of a good thing and something of a bad thing for the Kurds, because Assad was, frankly, too dense, too stupid to seize the opportunity. Sharah will absolutely seize any opportunity when it's greenlit by his case officer or whoever it is. So that case officer or whoever that is or whatever group of people that is knew that there was a lot of goodwill built up in the NATO community for the Kurds, because you can't live among the Kurds for very long without getting kind of fond of them. At least that's how it worked out for me. They're kind of a breath of fresh air, and they're willing to adapt. They change. They're highly intelligent. They move quickly. They want things to be different, and that's maybe the most important thing of all. And they can change. Change is very hard to come by in some regions. Like, it's very hard to come by in the American suburbs, certainly, and it's very hard to come by in most of the militarized parts of the Middle East. And the Kurds did change. They took back Kobani right in the teeth of Islamic State, and only belatedly did the Obama administration decide, mostly under pressure from its lower-ranking members, that we needed help, and we did finally help with some very lethal airstrikes. But then bigger issues were in play, and it's clear that under pressure from the Israeli government, which regarded the SDF, the Kurds, as disposable temporary assets, and the Turkish government, which frankly regarded them as implacable enemies mm-hmm. to be wiped out if possible and barely tolerated otherwise. And the U.S., which regarded the SDF mainly as like a bad hand in poker. Like, mm-hmm. They don't have the power to really overthrow anything, but, you know, they give it a good try. All those three players just decided we're going to throw in the Kurds right now, because we're going with Sharah. Sharah was not very popular with maybe civilians, but he is very popular with those who matter mm-hmm. because he solved a lot of problems in a hurry. And that's the good part about Sharah. He has, as far as I can tell, no shame, or his government has no shame. They'll turn on a dime. And turn on in the English idiomatic sense. They'll turn on anyone. And as opposed to the stiff-necked, kind of dumb attitude of the Assad government, which regarded the SDF's very existence as outrageous, the new regime in Damascus couldn't care less. Like, if all three or maybe more of their backers sign off on a project, they'll turn. They'll turn quickly. So now the Damascus regime has signed a deal with the SDF in Syria. And it's not a good deal, but it's not as bad as one would expect, because the new regime is going from a position of great strength right now. And they're winning. They're very powerful. And they are willing to let the SDF, under this new policy they have, control local law enforcement in Kurdish areas. They're willing to let people celebrate Nowruz, the Kurdish New Year festivities of a really interesting hangover from the old Zoroastrian days. And they basically saying, okay, you can be Kurdish, but don't fuck with us when we're doing big stuff. So they take over the interior ministry in the areas controlled by the local Kurdish police, but for the moment at least, and subject to some very scary warnings by the Turkish state, they are not at the moment going to march in and kill a lot of Kurds.
Right. Yeah, I read that the Israelis wanted to kind of help, because the Israeli interest is just in keeping Syria fractured. And the Turkish interest is crushing Kurds and using Syria as a you know, viable buffer to an increasingly violent, erratic Israel. And so the Turks really want Shara to centralize power badly. And the Turks, as we've said many times in the show, carry a lot of water in Washington. We know about Israel, because Israel can't stop bragging about it public. But the Turks are quieter about their influence, which is huge. And from what I understand, Tom Barrack, who's the kind of like ambassador at large for Trump in that area, he basically told the Israelis were kind of wanted to encourage the SDF to hold out for more. And Barrack told them, no, the Turks are what matter in this story here.
And yeah, it's sort of like, you've played this game long enough. It's time to close it down.
Yeah. And
just let the new administration in Damascus run everything.
And, you know, I've seen some people sort of disparage the Kurds and the SDF as a pure CIA op. And, well, actually, the CIA was more involved with the jihadis. I mean, that's kind of a joke. I think it was special forces.
That's really not true. I mean, the Kurdish aspirations, and unfortunately, that's all they've got, go back centuries. And really, they go back to Woodrow Wilson and the fact that he didn't know anything about that part of the world and wasn't concerned about it anyway.
Yeah. You know, we have to remember that the Kurdish statelet began, it wasn't in particularly open hostility with Assad. It's because when the Syrian civil war fractured the state, the YPGJ, with help from the PKK, which is definitely not in the CIA's pocket. It's the very opposite. Yeah. We've been helping Turks kill Kurds and PKK for decades now. So they helped set them up. It's basically was self-defense. And it was, when it was YPGJ, before the Americans got more involved, it was also kind of trying to practice a more radical, non-sectarian, non-gender, kind of leftist, anarcho-leftist, whatever you'd call it, politics. And that's what attracted people to it. And that's, the U.S. used, you know, they had a mutual interest in destroying ISIS, because ISIS were mostly killing Kurds at that time, you know, and Arabs. And so the U.S. helped them out. But eventually when the U.S. did get its claws in the Kurds and the YPGJ, when they transformed it to the SDF, there was a very kind of, you know, smart side to it, which was to show how non-sectarian it was by getting different Arab tribes who also didn't like jihadis involved in a more cross-sectarian group. But they also depoliticized the white. They gutted the politics out of them. So that
they really did. Yeah, I mean, I remember the early days, almost 10 years ago. Maybe it was 10 years ago, in fact, when Kobani was known to the world press as Ayn al-Arab, and it was just a dusty border station that. Had a mixed population because it was built around a railroad that went in the early 20th century. So they just attracted a lot of migrant workers. And at that time, when the SDF was really left to govern there because everybody else ran, the Assad government's representatives ran faster than anybody. They were very radical. They thought, yeah, okay, we can change this culture. And that's the most wonderful thing about the Kurds. They really want to change some really harsh aspects of the culture. They want to change the gender relations. They want to change the religious toleration. And they're willing to do that because really, what advantages did the old system have for them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the new things that was granted as a boon by the new administration in Damascus is that Syrian Kurds can now have passports. They didn't even have that right under Assad. So now at least they will have a grudging recognition of, yes, this is a Syrian Kurd. Still a Kurd, but, you know, officially Syrian. So, yes, we acknowledge him.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, look, the Kurds are, I imagine, are not stupid about the U.S. constantly selling them out, but also by aligning with the U.S., it's sort of, it's a gamble that's paid off some. It's resulted in a lot of disasters, but the only payoffs have come also from agreeing to be the U.S., you know, cat's paw,
yeah,
and so it's, you know, power and all, it's not a pretty business. It's ugly, but like they do have, for the first time ever, you know, their own essentially statelet and autonomy in Iraq, and that was hard won after a lot of death and massacre and oppression and so on. And so I would imagine it's hard for them, even given what the U.S. has done with Turkey to Kurds in and the PKK in Turkey. It still would be very hard for them to turn on the U.S. And probably even when it was clear by the later, you know, by the mid-late part of Trump's first term that at some point the U.S. is going to turn on them. At some point, it's going to happen because Turkey matters.
It really was a Trump administration, Trump II administration decision.
Yeah.
There has been some kind of complex backroom negotiation between the second Trump administration and Israel. And it seems to cover an awful lot of ground. And one of those is like, yeah, okay, we serve up the SDF to you and your frenemies up there in Turkey, and you sort of got to take it easy, okay? You going to take it easy? Yeah, yeah. Nobody really believes it, but that's the story.
Yeah, I mean, I should clarify. I mean, the Turkish state, not Turks. Turks have a the big variety of politics and have been facing their own problems within Turkey. But the Turkish state is a scary state, and it draws a lot of water in Washington and London, and the Kurds.
And as you said, it draws a lot of water without attracting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I mean, Israel is a hot issue now, and anything that the U.S. does in cooperation with Israel even though it still goes over with the rather dull mass of Americans, it annoys a lot of people. But turkey, no. They go along with anything.
I mean, to be fair, also the, you know, Turkish culture, Turkish people don't try and force on us, I don't know, constantly how great and perfect turkey is. And if you ever criticize turkey, you're a turkophobe or something. Like, you know, yeah. it's not as culturally embedded and hasn't received probably the same amount of aid that Israel has. And they do operate in a quieter and more backroom level, but they're all up in academia, media, think tank land. And this is important for Turkey, that Shiraz is more than anybody's Turkey's project. So yeah, that's happening. But at least, yeah, I thought they were actually going to be, because when Shiraz made his first moves, he did the usual thing, which is you start with your kind of semi-state jihadi death squads to go in and terrorize populations, cut off some heads, posted on video. They were doing that to the Kurds, if you saw some of that.
Yeah.
And then they come in with the more state actors to quote unquote, you know, bring back stability, but really to impose.
Good old Machiavellian stuff. Like, you know, bring in the head choppers first and then they'll settle for anything.
So it looks like the Kurds, at least thus far, are not being subjected to the same level of terror and cleansing that the Alawites.
Yeah, and when I looked into this more, I mean, it made a lot of sense to me because even though this is an anecdotal impression, Kurdish people that I've known are very bright, and their failure to take up an opportunity, as I saw it, to negotiate with the Bashar al-Assad regime seemed foolish. But what I've read lately is that's not what happened. Assad was just, all his people were outraged against the Kurds. There's a lot of, you know, free-floating outrage against the Kurds all over the place in the Middle East.
Right. Let's just wrap it up, I don't know, with a quick couple bullet points here, I guess, because we've been going on.
Mm-hmm.
One story, just, you know, again, with Russia-Ukraine, of course, there's still ongoing talks, and I'm still going to stick by what I've been saying since early last year when Trump first, which, you know, again, I think it's good that Trump is trying to get them talking, trying to get them to ceasefire. At least when you're negotiating, even if you're not going to come to any agreement, you do know where the other side is for whenever the day comes when you are ready to negotiate. But Trump did, I think, get both sides to agree to a temporary ceasefire on hitting each other's energy infrastructure. And it's really because Russia has been absolutely decimating Ukraine's energy infrastructure. And Ukraine, especially like Kyiv, the capital, and the more northern parts, is under the same sort of hellish Arctic freeze lately like Rochester has had. And Russia has been degrading their energy infrastructure sort of layer by layer over the last year. And now they're kind of going in for the kill. And they're at a point now where Ukraine's energy infrastructure really is fully collapsing. Like it's no longer at a point where you can patch it up. It's actually deeply collapsing.
We're still at the beginning of February, so there's a lot of winter left. I wonder if there was a meteorological dimension to the Russian strategy, because we noticed and we pointed out many times that you'd think they'd hit the energy infrastructure in Kyiv in winter time, but there was a series of pretty mild winters in the early years of the war.
Also, you know, we're going to have to wait till the war's over to find out what the real thinking was, because also our thinking was, wait a minute, the U.S. takes out everything, water, sewage, electricity, wherever it fights anybody. It's the first thing they do. And it's all crimes against humanity, but also it's dual use is the argument. So it, and anyway, the U.S. doesn't get charged with crimes against humanity. And so it's hard to know. Did the Russians not do it because of their political goals in the war? Did they not do it because they weren't capable? Are they doing it now more because we know that Ukraine's anti-missile defense systems have been, I mean, its air defense systems have been massively depleted because the West doesn't make enough anymore and it's needed for Israel and the U.S. and the Middle East. Whereas on the opposite side, Russia is, it's like what we've been talking about with Anibale about the Soviets, not quite at that level, but similar. They're able to churn out like Iskander ballistic missiles, constantly upgraded Garands, the that was originally based on the Shahid drone, but now they're like jet engine. They're full on cruise missile drones now. Russia's producing a lot of missiles. And this is going to be a subject for a future episode, but missiles versus anti-missile, you know, air defense systems, like the balance, if you look at Iran, Israel, and you look at Russia, Ukraine, the balance is really shifting. Like you would, in the old days, you would think, well, either you have you could maybe mass produce a real turkey of a missile like the Scud, like Sodom's, which doesn't really do anything. But now that, you know, missiles have gotten better, cheaper, and when you mix them in with swarms, I mean, the science of missile attacks, of ballistic missile attacks, yeah, non-nuclear, is so
and
much more advanced.
And the complexity of an anti-missile missile versus a straightforward armed missile is vast. And
yes,
the expense of making an anti-missile missile
exactly
is enormous.
Exactly. It's the THAAD especially. I mean, they're as precious as Pink Panther stones. It's ridiculous. And so like just last night,
ba-dum.
I know. So just yesterday, Russia broke the ceasefire and launched, it could be more. This is just one of the figures I've seen, 34 Iskander M's, 20 KH-101 cruise missiles, 18 KH-22s, cruise missiles, 12 caliber cruise missiles, 2 Zykron hypersonic cruise missiles. So it's 86, along with a lot of drones. And Ukraine has really run out of a lot of its air defense systems. So they're just wiping out substations. And in a place like Kyiv, John, you remember from Moscow, in the winter, all the buildings have this centralized heating through heated up radiators, right? So it, like, there are the kind of regional power plants that pump in hot water through the radiators, and you regulate the heat.
And there are tubes around every building, you know?
Exactly, yes. And you regulate in your apartment the heat, because it can get really hot, through the little forshitka, whatever, the little tiny window.
Or in theory, you regulate it.
Well, if it gets cold, you don't. it gets too hot.
Oh, it gets way too hot.
Yeah. So what's happened by the Russians taking out the power and heating plants as well is that for millions of homes, the water in the pipes is frozen and bursts the pipes. So the damage they're doing it's really deep. And I think two things are going on. One is the Russians are kind of trying to, first of all, at this time in the season, it's a lot harder for Russia to make even the kind of smaller advances. You know, this isn't a super maneuver-based warfare. So it's much harder to take territory right now because there are no leaves on any, or, you know, all the bushes are bare, all the trees are bare, so you can't hide from drones. Your heat signature is much clearer in the cold. So save people and just make the civilian population suffer. And I think maybe they're also getting to the point where you're getting closer, even though I don't think we're near it yet, but you are certainly getting closer to the day when there will be serious negotiations for an end to the war. And so you try to put on the kibosh even harder as you get closer to that.
Yeah.
I think is kind of what's happening there.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like that. It feels like, oh, the hell with the aftermath. I mean, let's just take these things out.
Yeah, make them, you know, make them say uncle is kind of the point right now. Yeah, anyways, there's a lot of other stuff going on in the world that we will talk about in another episode. There was a fascinating story about Somalia, which makes sense, basically funding separatist groups within separatist Somaliland as punishment for the Israelis recognizing it and the UAE instrumentalizing it. There was a fascinating story on how Egypt, this sort of massive drone base that it's opened up in the very south of Egypt, and the World War I-ish alliances that are playing out through proxies in Sudan, just as they have through Yemen and elsewhere. There's a lot going on in the Horn, so we can save that for another episode.
There's a lot going
episode.
On in the Horn, in Tigray, and
yes.
There's probably going to be a big war again in the Horn.
It does look that way. And just in the same way, as I said, I just can't see that Russia and Ukraine have reached a point where one side's going to give in to the other. The Ukrainians aren't there yet, and the Russians definitely aren't there yet. So on that miserable note, let's end the episode. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks, John and Brendan. Talk
Thanks,
to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.